MacCast, Wednesday, March 30th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? It's been a little while since we've talked. I've been battling and fighting off a cold that seems to not want to go away, but we're going to try and trudge through in this episode. I know last time we kind of went long, so hopefully that held you for the time we've been down for a little bit, but we have lots of stuff to talk about today. New iOS rumors. It seems to be every time this time of year rolls around, we've just had the new iPads come out. We're in that little lull period of waiting for the next thing to come from Apple. We've got rumors about WWDC and Lion and what's going to happen with iOS 5 and the iPhone 5. And we also, in between there, had an international launch of the iPad 2. So we'll talk a little bit about supplies and things like that, along with a whole bunch of other stuff. Of course, your questions and comments. And it should be a lot of fun. So hang in there. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Absolutely fabulous application for taking notes, jotting down your thoughts and ideas. And if you've never checked out Notebook before, I would encourage you to head over to the circusponies.com site and just download the demo and try it. And if you're worried about getting up and running, they actually make it pretty easy to get started with Notebook. They have these great starting points. So when you launch the application, just go under Open New Starting Point, and they already have kind of a bunch of predefined templates and starter projects that you can kind of open up and get your feet wet with. And then also on their site, there's great tutorials, great how-tos that were done by Don McAllister of Screencasts Online. And then they also have a really neat community of Circus Ponies Notebook users that you can find in their forums. So there's a hints and tips section. There's another section that has additional templates and starting points and things that people exchange. So you're definitely not on your own with Circus Ponies, and their support is great and just all around a really great product. So if you haven't checked it out, head over to the website, circusponies.com, download the trial and give it a shot. I think you're really going to like it. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their continued support of the MacCast. Over the past few years, Apple seems to have been on a yearly release cycle for the iPhone, and it seems to come out around June, around the WWDC timeframe. We either have an announcement or actually a shipping product at that time. I think historically, the past few years, they've actually announced or shown off the new hardware a little bit early and then released in June. But this time around, it might be a little bit different, at least according to a number of the different sources. They're saying that the iPhone 5 launch might be moved to the fall. It all kind of got kicked off, I think, with a rumor out of TechCrunch saying that Apple wasn't going to ship iOS 5 until the fall timeframe. Still expected that Apple will show off iOS at the upcoming WWDC conference, which we have some interesting news about in a minute. But as far as what might be featured in the next version of the iOS, well, a bunch of the reports are saying that we will finally see the cloud-based iTunes. And there has been rumors that Apple's been working on that for a long time, but maybe some of the holdup has been the deals with the music studios. There's a couple holdouts and Apple's trying to still close up those deals. I don't know if that's related to a potential delay of iOS 5. I would doubt that, but it could be good timing for Apple to push it back a little bit so they can get those deals done and actually launch the iOS with the iTunes Cloud initiative put in there. The announcement of iOS 5 is expected to, or the release, excuse me, of iOS 5 is expected to coincide with new iPods and possibly a new iPad also rumored to be coming out in the fall. It's unclear whether or not a new iPad would be actually a redesign or just simply a revamp of the iPad 2, possibly with the improved screen we had been hearing about, more of the Retina style display that didn't make it into the current shipping version of the iPad 2. iOS 5 is also expected to include a number of other new features, including the rumored social features, that Find My Friends capability that we'd been hearing about that's sort of tied into the GPS system, so you'd be able to find friends that you have around you with your iOS devices. Also, a new and improved notification system, which I think would be a welcome addition, something that many of us have been wanting to see in iOS, not just that little pop-up window that gets pushed out of the way when you receive a new alert, but something more like maybe some of the other competing operating systems have, like Android. Actually, specifically, it might be a lot like what we've seen on Palm's webOS. Last June, Apple actually hired Palm's webOS notification designer. He was a former Apple employee and is coming back to Apple, Rich Dillinger. So they've been supposedly making improvements to that system. Upgraded maps are also likely to show up in iOS 5. Could possibly be based on Apple's own mapping system. If you remember, Apple acquired a couple different mapping companies over the past few years, PlaySpace and Poly9, and we haven't really seen or we don't really know what they've done with that technology. A lot of Apple's acquisitions lately have tended to be for the talent that are at these companies, but given the relationship between Google and Apple, Google doing the Android operating system, Apple may be trying to separate itself a little bit more from Google, and we could see an Apple mapping system finally, native mapping system finally in iOS 5. Another area of the iOS that might get a bump up due to a recent acquisition by Apple is the voice control system. It would be expanded system-wide and not just include new commands, but potentially a smarter artificial intelligence for doing things like search and other voice operations on the phone. The technology would be expanded beyond just voice recognition and also enhance the assistive technologies that are built into iOS, and that's always nice to see coming from Apple. They've done a great job with the different assistive technologies built into iOS, and could open up the system to third-party developers via API, since it would be integrated and built into the entire iOS. If you remember, back in April of 2010, Apple acquired a company called Siri, who had an app that would allow you to just say regular phrases into their software, and then it could perform various tasks. So you could do things like, say, make me dinner reservations at this restaurant for 8 p.m. on Thursday, and it could actually decipher that and go out and perform those operations through things like OpenTable and Google Calendar and what have you. And so Apple picked up that company and is likely rolling that technology into the operating system. So that should be very interesting to see and help bring them more in line with some of the voice control that's in some of the other applications. And again, separating itself from Google, which also offers certain types of voice commands and control within their own apps on the iOS. And what about the hardware? Well, we're not expecting to see a huge bump up in the hardware in terms of the design or form factor. I would expect we would see a move to the new dual-core A5 processor that we've seen in the iPad 2, also a bump up in the graphics performance, just like the iPad 2. As far as the physical design, it's expected it would be pretty much the same. I haven't heard anything about updates to the camera. Same thickness, same kind of form factor. There are some rumors that Apple might go edge to edge on the screen, possibly accommodating up to a 4-inch display. It might be tight to pack it in there without actually changing the physical dimensions of the current phone, but rumors are out there that it might happen. Also, the back plate is expected to be moved away from the glass in the current iPhone 4 and possibly to a metal backplate, which would offer, I think, a little more ruggedness to the phone and at least change up the design a little bit, bringing it more in line with the other iOS devices like the iPad 2. As far as the internals go, some rumors are saying Apple will move the antennas away from the current design that kind of got them in trouble with AntennaGate and put them back inside the phone. And it's also expected that Apple will switch up the wireless chipsets, moving to a Qualcomm baseband chip that would support 4G LTE networks. Qualcomm is expected to ship some new versions of those chips in the fall, which might also be part of the reason for the moved release date that we're hearing rumors about, but that's just speculation on my part. One of the things Apple has kind of commented on is that the current generation of LTE chip technologies would potentially require a design change in the phone that they weren't willing to make. The newer chips are expected to offer better battery performance and might, as I said, be better timing for LTE rollouts of the carriers. LTE networks are being built out as quickly as possible by a number of the carriers, and AT&T is expected to get a big bump up with their acquisition of T-Mobile should that go through. So that might happen by that time in the fall, and it could be more, or it could be just a better timing, I think, for Apple to release a new version of the phone given that time frame. So we'll have to wait for WWDC to see what happens and see what Apple announces and talks about. But a lot of people are speculating that it's mostly going to be all about the software, both Lion, which we'll talk about here in a second, and iOS 5, and not necessarily the hardware. So who knows if we'll even get a glimpse of the iPhone hardware, but some people are saying that we won't. As far as WWDC goes, well, this week proved very interesting for WWDC. It sold out within a matter of hours. So if you were planning on getting tickets and going, you're going to probably have to check eBay, and you're going to be paying a pretty penny for those tickets. The event is going to take place on June 6th through the 10th in San Francisco at Moscone West, where it has just about every year for the past few years. The event typically hosts about 5,000 developers, and this year all of those slots were sold within 8 to 10 hours, which is just incredibly fast. I think last year the reports I was reading about said 8 days to sell out. This time, you couldn't even get through half a day before all the tickets were gone. And as crazy as that seems, it does kind of make sense given the growth of especially iOS and the number of new developers coming to the platform. There's a lot of people that are going to be wanting to attend that event. And it did raise some questions this week as to Apple maybe needing to change some of its policies about how it sells tickets, because you could actually buy a ticket and not attend the event, even attend the event, because your ticket can actually be transferred to another person. So it's not like the person buying the ticket had to use the ticket. It actually can be transferred, and that gave rise to what we're seeing on eBay with tickets selling for over $2,500 US. The original price was about $1,600, and that is angering some people who were unable to get in. John Martellaro over at Mac Observer pointed out, too, that Apple has a situation with their international developers because many of them probably were asleep when ticket sales started in the U.S. They might not have even been up thinking that it wasn't going to be a problem. In years past, as I mentioned, tickets sold out in about 8 days, not 8 hours. And so they were sleeping, thinking, oh, I'll get up and I'll order my ticket in the morning. And lo and behold, they aren't able to do that. So I don't know how Apple is going to handle or deal with this. Seems like they need to expand the venue at least for next year. So hopefully this will be a little bit of a learning lesson. It also seems like maybe they should take a look at ensuring that only, you know, developers who buy the tickets are going to be the ones that are going to be able to use the tickets, so that you don't have this kind of situation going on where people are just snapping up tickets and then scalping them, trying to turn around and make a quick buck. But even with the fallout from the ticket ordering fiasco, I think WWDC is one of the premier events that Apple puts on every year, and we're always excited to see what they're going to be showing off to us. It's, like I said earlier, sounding like it's going to be mostly about software this year, and I look forward to reporting to you what exactly happens come June. This past week also saw the launch internationally of the iPad 2. It was opened up to a number of other countries, and many of you reported to me that it was pretty much a repeat of the U.S. launch in terms of the lines, a lot of long lines at Apple stores and resellers throughout the globe. Also reported sellouts that happened very quickly in most places, and I don't think there was any big surprises there. As far as the number of units that were sold internationally, I'm hearing pretty much numbers in the same range that we heard about with the U.S. launch, maybe in the 500,000, 600,000 unit range in the countries that Apple launched in. One thing that has been noted, and I've typically defended this in the past, but I'm not sure I can this time around, is that prices internationally seem to be quite a bit higher than they are, say, in the U.S. That's even after adjusting for things like the VAT and GST taxes that are often on the pricing that appears on Apple's products in other countries, and also adjusting for exchange rates. I saw one study that took a look at the numbers across the countries that support the euro, And iPad 2 pricing seemed to be about $100 to $200 more than the US prices after making those adjustments. In the past, I think I've noticed a difference of about $50 to $100. So this seems to be about double that this time around. And I'm not sure what accounts for those differences. A lot of people like to point to Apple just simply price gouging international customers. I don't know if I can definitively say that's what's going on here, but this time around does seem to be a little bit more suspect. I have to imagine, though, that there are additional costs of doing business in different countries, and I don't understand all of the tariffs and other taxes, import laws, and stuff that Apple might be dealing with, and they might need to factor into their calculations. If you know about this stuff and maybe have a little bit of insight and can either defend or admonish Apple on it, then let me know. Send me an email, and I'll try and look into it further. I've tried looking into this in the past, and all I can come up with is the standard tax stuff. But somebody who maybe better understands import-export laws and things like that might have some additional insight. In case you missed it, Apple released an update to iOS 4.3. The iOS 4.3.1 update came out. It fixed a number of issues, including occasional graphics glitches on the iPod Touch 4th generation. Also resolved bugs related to activating and connecting to some cellular networks. Fixed an image flicker issue when using the Apple Digital AV adapter on some televisions. That was reported by a number of people who had, I think, Vizio sets, among others. If you had a new iPad 2 and were using that Digital AV connector, that's the new one that allows you to do direct HDMI from the iPad 2 and other iOS devices. Also resolves an issue with authenticating on some enterprise web services, and reportedly fixes the battery issues from the iOS 4.3 update. And I can kind of confirm that. I had noted right after doing the iOS 4.3 update that my iPhone got about half the battery life that it did prior, and I had noticed some strange issues with just how the battery depleted on my iPad too. It seemed to go down a lot more quickly on the front end and then kind of slow down on the back end, and it now seems to be a little more even in terms of how it how the battery drains out. And I'm still getting good battery life out of my iPad too. I don't think that ever was an issue. It seemed to go for about 2-3 days with normal usage, pretty heavy usage on my part, without having to recharge. My iPhone 4 typically goes 2-3 days as well, and I use both those devices pretty actively. The update, interestingly, wasn't available or isn't out for the Verizon iPhone 4, and many users are just scratching their heads wondering, myself included, if you have a Verizon iPhone 4, you're still running iOS 4.6.2 or 4.2.6, excuse me, and that is the current release for those devices, so I'm not sure why the two releases are out of sync, but they are, so don't worry if you've noticed the update didn't come out for you and you have a Verizon iPhone 4. As far as what's on the horizon for the next update to the Mac hardware line, it's looking like the iMacs are due, at least according to the rumors that are heating up right now. It's not expected to be a major update, just a bump. We are hearing rumors that Apple will put out new models with dual or quad-core Sandy Bridge processors, so an upgrade to the latest Intel chipsets. Also, probably upgraded graphics processors, including the Intel integrated HD graphics and AMD processors, similar to what we saw in the latest revs of the MacBook Pros. And would you be surprised if I told you they're expected to have Thunderbolt ports on the new iMacs? I don't think that would be a shocker to anyone. That's the technology Apple's going to be supporting moving forward for I/O, and we will see that in the next generation iMac. I'm almost positive about that. As for design, not any major design changes being announced or rumored. Probably going to be the same size screens. I wouldn't expect any huge resolution changes, anything like that. And I would assume pricing would remain the same. As for release time frame, the rumors are saying late April, early May for the update, and I think it'll be a pretty quiet update, probably something Apple just releases out on their website. So if you've been in the market for a new desktop Mac and it's not absolutely critical that you buy one today, you might want to hold off for about 6 to 8 weeks and see what Apple might have up its sleeve. Apple updated Snow Leopard 10.6.6, what, about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago, with the release of 10.6.7. And I think the upgrade went smoothly for most people. I really didn't have any issues with it, but there is a bug being reported by some users that is related to OpenType fonts. It can impact printing within certain applications that use the OpenType fonts, apps like Pages and Office. It also seems to impact PDF generation from some applications, specifically apps that use macOS 10's built-in PDF render engine. Applications that don't use the built-in engine but actually have their own seem to be okay. And as far as viewing PDFs generated with the OpenType fonts, Preview itself doesn't seem to have an issue because I guess it doesn't support the full PDF specification, something that I wasn't aware of until I read a piece by Tidbits, who kind of explains what's going on and how this bug manifested itself. I guess what happens is there's a definition within PDFs, or that's encoded into PDFs, that describe how glyphs should be encoded, and some sort of change in 10.6.7 resulted in PDFs ending up with an incorrect encoding definition. It does seem to only affect OpenType PostScript fonts, and so if you are affected by the issue, the workaround would be to use a non-OpenType PostScript version of the same font. That could be difficult depending on your application, and if you have mission critical stuff and you can't avoid switch, or you can't afford to switch fonts, then you're going to have to roll back to macOS 10.6.6, which unfortunately is easier said than done, because in order to do it, you're basically going to have to reinstall from scratch. You're going to have to go back to your original system disk, reinstall the operating system, wiping out the current updated 10.6.7 OS, and then reapplying Apple's OS 10.6.6 combo updater. So hopefully you have good backups and can roll back to that. If you are relying on OpenType PostScript fonts, you may, and you haven't upgraded yet, you may want to hold off until Apple actually releases a fix for this bug. One other bug that impacted a small subset of macOS 10 users was actually patched. It's a bug that affected 13-inch MacBook Air owners. That's the late 2010 MacBook Airs. It's actually titled macOS 10 version 10.6.7, a supplemental update for the 13-inch MacBook Air late 2010. Quite a mouthful to say that update name, but it addresses an issue that makes the system unresponsive when using iTunes. So if you had applied that upgrade and you are a MacBook Air owner and suddenly your iTunes stopped working, you probably want to grab this update. It is available through Software Update Utility or on Apple's website at apple.com/support. Something I'm noticing about my new iPad 2 is that for some reason it seems to be a little more durable or a little more rugged than my iPad 1, at least in terms of scratching. Something I was very concerned about, especially with just having the smart cover, which only covers the front of the iPad, was that the back of it would get scratched up just with normal usage. Now, I haven't put any kind of film or anything on the back of mine, but I've noticed that the metal seems to be holding up pretty well. I have a slight ding on one corner, or kind of scratch on one corner, where the texture, I don't know how to describe this other than sort of the texture that's on the metal is kind of worn off or rubbed off. It's a really tiny dot. Most people wouldn't even notice it. But I'm not really sure what Apple has done to the back, whether it has some sort of coating or some sort of application to it. But even the plastic Apple logo is not getting scratched up. And I haven't had that same situation happen with some of my other devices. The other area of the iPad I was a bit concerned about was the front glass. Apple has made it quite a bit thinner. As a matter of fact, a lot of the reports are saying it's 27% thinner than the iPad 1 glass, and we know from early testing with the iPad 1s that in drop tests and things like that done by independent companies like iFixit or some of these other sites, it showed that the glass was pretty breakable. If you would drop it, it broke pretty easily. Well, there are now reports coming out that are saying the iPad 2 glass could be even stronger than the iPad 1 glass, even though it is quite a bit thinner. This is coming out of Fix Your Eye. They did some torture testing on the iPad 2 glass and found that I don't know if it's because it's thinner or if it's a different material, but they found it to be very flexible. They tried very hard to break it and could actually get it to flex a lot more than the original iPad glass. And that seems to support some of the theories that Apple is using a different type of glass technology. It was rumored that the iPad 1 had Corning Gorilla Glass. Supposedly, Apple is using Asahi Dragon Trail Glass in the iPad 2, and it is much more flexible and allows the glass to be quite a bit thinner, two properties that Apple has obviously put into the iPad 2 design. So it does make sense. And watching the videos is pretty incredible to see how much the glass can flex. And I guess it's that flexibility that allows it to not break when it actually gets dropped or something like that. And so I appreciate it being thinner and more flexible, and looks like the iPad 2 is probably a little bit more rugged than its predecessor. And then lastly in the news for today, Apple released an update to its developer build of macOS 10.7. 10.7 Lion Developer Preview 2 was released. It's labeled build number 11A419, and we're starting to get the reports of what is actually been updated. Two significant items, iCal and iChat. On the iCal side, it's been given the sort of leather-bound facelift that we saw in the address book. That was part of, I think, the first build of 10.7, but I guess it's been updated a little bit more and more closely matches what we've seen with some of the updates on the iOS, as well as in the web-based version, the Mobile Me version of iCal. iChat reportedly now has a single view of all your different chat services, more like Adium or some of the other clients that are out there that consolidate everything. Part of 10.7 was the addition of support for Yahoo Messenger, which has been added to the first beta of Lion, and that continues with beta build 2 or preview 2, and integrates Bonjour, AIM, and Jabber support along with Yahoo Messenger and iChat all into a single interface. So that's going to be interesting to see. And something that is, depending on your perspective, maybe disappointing is Apple seems to have removed FTP support, or not necessarily support, but FTP options from the system preferences sharing file sharing options, meaning you don't have that nice little GUI for enabling FTP. You can still enable FTP from the command line, and you'll also still be able to connect to FTP servers from the Finder using the connect to server feature. That's the one that gives you the ability to actually read but not write to FTP servers. But Apple has opted with removing it from the GUI in favor of adding WebDAV sharing, which should be nice for working with iOS devices, considering that many iOS apps can actually connect to and communicate with WebDAV servers. So you'll be able to quickly and easily turn that on from the file sharing options within 10.7. But if you want to do FTP, you're going to have to resort to probably some third-party utilities or just head on down to the command line through the terminal if you know how to do that. Despite what some blogs are saying, this does not appear to be the gold master build of 10.7. I wouldn't have expected it to be, at least not this early. Lion's not due out until this summer, probably right after WWDC. I'm sure we'll be seeing some of the final features and stuff in the WWDC announcements and keynotes and things like that, and then a release date probably following within weeks of us seeing that build. So there's still a healthy list of bugs and items for developers to check in the preview too. And I'm sure they'll report those things, and we'll get some more bug fixes and probably a few more releases before the actual final Gold Master released. So don't believe everything you read on some of those blogs and things like that. And then to go along with the updated Lion preview, Apple also did update the tools for developers. Xcode 4.1 Developer Preview 2 was released at the same time. So if you're in the developer program and haven't upgraded, you might want to log in and grab that as well. On the MacCast, we've talked quite a bit about some of the accessibility features that are built into Mac OS X, or actually more specifically, we've talked a lot about VoiceOver, which is the built-in screen reader on Mac OS X, which is it's a great feature, something that you have to pay a lot extra for when you're on other platforms like Windows, and it's built right into Mac OS X. But another thing that's built into Mac OS X that we haven't talked too much about is voice recognition. And I received this question from Phil related to that.
Hi, Adam. This is Phil from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I remember a couple shows ago you had a discussion about accessibility features for the blind specifically. And I wanted to ask you a couple questions about accessibility features from a different standpoint, and that is voice control of your Mac. I've been trying to switch my dad to a Mac for a while. The trick is that he has multiple sclerosis and he can't use his hands. So he controls his computer all through voice control. He uses Nuance's Dragon Naturally Speaking on his PC. And that's essentially the thing that's really kept him tied to a PC, is that he knows that Dragon works extremely well with his PC and it does what he needs it to do. So my question is what kind of features and functionality does the Mac have for voice control? I know that there's some capability built into the OS, and I know that Nuance also makes Dragon Dictate, I think is what it's called for Mac, but I'm very curious as if you know or have any experience with how well that works. So if you or anybody of your listeners could help out, that would be great. Would really love to get my dad onto a Mac. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Phil, we'd love to get your dad onto a Mac too, and I think we can do that. I'm definitely not an expert in this area. I probably should bring on some of my friends who know a little bit more about accessibility features in Mac OS X than I do, but we'll throw it out to the community. I'm sure some of you out there might have an answer to Phil's question, but I'll tell you what I do know, and a lot of it comes from just playing around with some of the built-in features. So after I received your email, I thought, you know what, I better take a look at the speech features that are built into Mac OS X, and you can do this for yourself. You can go into the system preferences and go to the speech preferences and simply turn this on. You can turn on speech recognition. I don't know if you're aware or not, but the speech recognition, there is speech recognition built in. It's been around for a while, and when you turn it on, I think you'll notice even the UI kind of shows a little bit of its age. So I think it's one of those areas that's been a little bit neglected by Apple. But if you go into the speech recognition and just turn on speakable items, you will get a bunch of different options. You can adjust some of the settings, like setting a listening key, which is a key that you would hold down or press before it actually starts listening to what you're talking or listening to the commands that you might say into it. You can use the built-in mic. It will also work with headset mics and other things like that. You might get better performance using a more dedicated mic. You can also set a keyword command, meaning something you have to say or a command you have to say before speaking the actual command that will activate it and alert the Mac that you're actually going to tell it a speech command. But fine-tune the features to get it working the way you'd like. And then once you have it enabled, if you'd like to see the list of commands that you can actually use, what you can do is you can say, through the speech recognition, open speech command windows, or I think also show speakable items is another option. And there's a little window that will pop up and it'll show you a list of all the available commands. A fun one, if you just want to play around with it, is you can say, tell me a joke, and your Mac will actually tell you a joke. Very often a knock-knock joke, and you can talk back and forth with your Mac. It's kind of funny and a neat little tech demo to play around with if you have friends around and you're trying to show them some of the speech capabilities. But you can also look a little bit silly because sometimes it doesn't actually recognize your commands, so it's a little bit hit or miss. Although I played with it after receiving your voicemail, and I have to say it worked pretty well. And one of the nice things is that you can actually add your own commands, and you can actually use AppleScript to create your own commands. So if you actually write an AppleScript and you want to trigger it through voice, all you have to do is save the AppleScript into the speakable items folder, which you'll find inside the library folder under speech, under speakable items in your home folder. And so just save an AppleScript file in there, and then whatever you name the AppleScript file, so for example, say we created an AppleScript file called helloworld.script, then in speakable items, we would just say the command hello world, and then it would execute and run our Apple script as long as it's in that speakable item's location. The other thing I noticed when I was playing around with it is, for example, I tried to use Safari, and there's some commands that you can do to actually operate Safari. But if you want to add keyboard shortcuts or keyboard commands, voice keyboard commands, you can actually add those as well. So you can add your own custom ones. You define the keyboard key you want to set a voice command for, and then add a voice command, and then anytime you say that command, it will actually execute that keyboard shortcut. So I was able to do something like really quickly script out the finder and do things like, say, next item, which would cause my selection in the finder to jump down to the next item, or previous item, or go into folder, and then it would go into the folder. And all I was doing was defining the arrow keys, which you can set up for navigation in the finder, and then assigning voice commands to those arrow keys. And that worked really well. And that was all built in without any additional software. But I have to say, it's kind of kludgy, and you do have to do a lot of manual operation to set it up. And that may or may not be something that is very easy for your dad to do. So you mentioned Dragon in there, Nuance Dragon Dictate, which is available on the Mac. And it is an incredible application, and it has all kinds of built-in code and things like that for executing commands, voice commands on your Mac. And I would say, if you're going to get really serious about this stuff, and it sounds like you are, that's probably the way you want to go. I'm not super familiar with it, but they do offer those voice commands. I think it is also scriptable. And one feature that it has that I didn't see built into Mac OS X, and we might discover this later if one of you know this does exist, but definitely with Dragon Dictate, what you can do is you can turn on mouse controls, voice-activated mouse controls, and they have something called the mouse grid, which when you activate it, you get quadrants of your screen, I think labeled 1 through 9. I think it's 3 across and 3 down, and you say a number, so you say go to quadrant 3 or whatever it is. I forget the specific command, but you can go to square 3 on the grid and it'll zoom into that location, and then it'll give you another grid over that area, and you keep honing in on the specific section you want to get to, and then you can eventually click on something. And they have commands for actually dragging and moving items around on the screen, and you can really control the whole Mac entirely with your voice using Dragon Dictate. And they have some videos on their website to kind of show how that works. And it was pretty amazing. I watched through those videos, and you can really do a lot just with the power of your voice using Dragon technology. And Dragon definitely has the best speech recognition technology out there. I don't think there's anybody who really argues that. So I would look into that. Nuance.com is the website, and I think that's probably the way to go, at least for now. I wish Apple would pick back up where they left off with some of their speech technologies, but I think they are kind of showing their age, unless there's something I'm completely missing, and I'm sure someone in the community will let us know if we've missed that. But thanks for your question, Phil. The next question I have actually comes from the MacCast website, from the comments, and I don't think I've answered too many questions from the comments, but if you have them, that's a great place to put them. And this one comes from Gary. He was wondering about doing offline email on the iPhone, specifically composing and then sending emails later. He wanted to be able to respond in offline mode when he was on a train. I guess he's in an area where he doesn't have any signal, either 3G or Wi-Fi. And while he could easily do that, because when you check your mail, it does download your emails to your device, and then you can actually go in and start composing an email and then save that off. The problem was that every time he hit send, I guess it would try and make a connection and then pop up an alert, which, as you would imagine, would get very annoying. You know, if it keeps popping up every time you're adding a new email to the queue, that could get very frustrating, especially if you're responding to a lot of email. And he was wondering if there was a way to avoid that pop-up alert. And I looked into this a little bit and found that the easiest way to do it is to actually force the phone or the iOS device to know that you don't have any kind of active connection. And the easiest way to do that was to put it into airplane mode. So on the iPhone or your iOS device, if you go into the settings, you should see a little checkbox. And I didn't have an iPod Touch to test on this. I don't know if an iPod Touch has a quote-unquote airplane mode, but I would imagine if it doesn't, you could just simply turn off the Wi-Fi. So go into the Wi-Fi settings and turn it off. But on an iPhone, you have airplane mode, which is just a little switch right at the root of the settings. Go into settings, turn that into airplane mode, and that will shut off all of the cellular and wireless connections. And then when you launch mail, at least for me, it didn't pop up that annoying message. I could actually draft and compose emails on the device, and then when I got to an active connection, took it out of airplane mode and launched mail, it went through the process of actually sending those emails. So Gary, give that a shot. I think that's going to work for you. And sticking on the topic of email for a little bit, I have a question from David, who is having an issue where his Gmail account, even though it's set up on IMAP, is giving him a little bit of trouble. Specifically, what's happening is he'll receive email from the Gmail account. He'll get the little status update on his dock icon showing that he has new mail that's come in. And when he goes to check it and look in his inbox in mail.app, lo and behold, the messages aren't there. They're actually in the all mail folder, which is a special folder in Gmail that's under his Gmail account. And what he'd really like to do is see them in his inbox. So, David, I can imagine that would be very frustrating. And the reason that's happening is that Gmail, even though macOS 10 and iOS has support, quote unquote, support for Gmail, you have to set it up in a very specific way, and that can be a little bit tricky. This is actually a tip I learned from Dave Hamilton and John Braun over at the Mac Geek Gab podcast. If you haven't checked that out, you can find that over at macobserver.com. They do the Mac Geek Gab podcast. Great podcast with really cool hints and tips and tricks, and they answer people's questions and things like that. But the source of the problem is really kind of, there's two things going on with Gmail that kind of cause this issue. And what they are is that Gmail uses labels instead of traditional IMAP folders. They're really kind of the same thing with different terminology, not quite the same in Gmail's world, but a lot of times the Gmail label maps to an IMAP folder. And so that's one kind of issue. The other thing is the just standard differences or differences in the standard IMAP folder names. I've noticed that different services, different service providers use either a different folder name or a different directory structure for folders, specific folders. So, for example, your junk mail folder. It might be called junk by one service provider. It might be called spam by another service provider. And if the label or the folder name is different, that can cause some issues in mapping. Now, luckily, Apple has thought about this, and mail.app and the mail application built into iOS can kind of account for these differences. But you do need to set up and configure Gmail in a certain way and configure your clients in a certain way to get this all to kind of sort out. So the first step in this process, once you've enabled IMAP and Gmail, and I'm going to assume you've done that already, is you need to go into the Gmail settings area and go to the labs section and then find an option called advanced IMAP controls. And you want to turn on the advanced IMAP controls. And once you've done that, what it's going to do is it's going to open up some additional settings that are going to be helpful in your specific situation, because what you need to do is disable that all mail label for IMAP. And once you've turned on the advanced controls, all you have to do then is go back into settings, go under labels, the labels tab, and what you should see now is a show in IMAP column next to all of your labels. And at the very least, you're going to want to go in and uncheck the all mail folder so that doesn't show up to your IMAP clients, specifically in your case, it doesn't show up for mail.app. That way, those emails as they're coming in aren't going to go to that folder. They're actually going to go into your inbox where you're expecting to see them. Now, if there's other labels that you don't want to see in mail.app, so if you've set up filters or if you move things in Gmail into areas that you don't want to see in your mail.app, you can uncheck those IMAP folders as well. and they're not going to show up when you connect with your IMAP clients. But be aware of that, that when you uncheck those, they're not going to be available to any IMAP clients, and they're not going to see them. So after you've configured IMAP on the Gmail side, the next thing is to connect to Gmail servers and use that IMAP account. And one thing that's kind of counterintuitive, and you wouldn't think about this, is Apple has these presets for Gmail, both on iOS and in mail.app. So when you're setting up and telling it what kind of an account you want to connect to, they have this Gmail preset. You don't want to use that. And I know that seems counterintuitive, but we want a little more control over how we're connecting to and mapping out these IMAP folders and things like that. And to get that, we actually just want to connect to Gmail as a standard IMAP mail account. So just use the standard mail option and then select IMAP as the type of server that you're connecting to, and then plug in the IMAP server information for Gmail's IMAP servers, which you can get from their documentation, and just configure it like a standard IMAP account. And this is good because it'll work for even IMAP accounts that aren't Gmail. You'll do the same kind of process. So once you've set that up and you've confirmed that you're connected to the IMAP servers, the last step in this process is to take care of those folder mappings, to map the IMAP folders that Gmail has set up to the IMAP structure that mail.app or the iOS application uses. And the way you do that is, once you've set up your Gmail account in mail.app, you'll see you'll have a Gmail section under the folder list. And then within that section, you're going to have the standard folders, the sent mail folder, the trash folder, the drafts folder. And drafts is a kind of a special situation. We'll talk about that in a second. But what you're going to want to do is, say, map the sent folder in the Gmail section to the sent folder that you'll see up at the top of mail.app, which is where you're typically going to want to see your sent email. So the way you do that is you go down, you select the folder that's under the Gmail folder list called sent, and then go under the mailbox menu and choose the use this mailbox for option, and then select the appropriate matching folder, in this case the sent folder, and that will map Gmail's IMAP sent folder to the macOS 10 sent folder, and then everything's going to show up where you want it to. And you'll do the same thing for the trash folder. Now, with the drafts folder, one thing to note, and I've actually mapped mine, but Dave Hamilton mentioned this to me, and I've noticed it myself, that if you map the drafts folder for some reason, especially if you're using multiple devices, so I have this map, you know, my IMAP account set up on my iOS devices, my iPad, my iPhone, and my Mac, occasionally you'll see duplicates in your draft folder, and you'll have to clean those up. So if you don't want to see that, you might not want to map your drafts folder. The thing about that is you're not necessarily going to sync. So if you start a draft on your iOS device and you haven't mapped the folder, when you get back to your Mac, it's not going to show up in the drafts folder on your Mac. But again, you're going to avoid the duplicates, so you're going to have to make your own call on that one. But once you've done that, everything should show up in its appropriate sections at the top of the mailbox list. And on iOS, it's a similar situation. You're going to go into your settings, you're going to go under mail, contacts, and calendars, you're going to select your Gmail account that you've set up using the standard IMAP setup, not the Gmail preset. And then you're going to go to the advanced area, scroll down and choose advanced, and then there you'll see three items under the mailbox behaviors. Again, if you're not using the preset, if you've used the preset, you're only going to see two mailbox behaviors, I think trash and sent, or trash and drafts. If you've done it using the standard email account, you're going to see the three options, trash, drafts, and sent items. And then you're going to want to map the sent mailbox to the appropriate location from the on the server section, where you're going to see, again, the sent mailbox, so sent to sent, and you just do those pairings, match them all up, and then everything will be set up properly. So hopefully I've explained that correctly. Dave actually has a great posting on macobserver.com. I'll link to that in the show notes that describes this whole process. So if anything I've said is a little bit confusing, go check out that article, and you'll find the link to that in the show notes. I have a correction, or actually more of a clarification from the last episode of the MacCast. I had been doing an interview and we were talking about file formats and backward compatibility and format shifting and things like that. And we had made it sound like Office 2004 files would not be able to be opened starting with Mac OS X 10.7. And the reason given for that was because there's no more Rosetta support in Mac OS X Lion, meaning that any applications that were written specifically for PowerPC machines are no longer going to run even in the Rosetta emulation mode in Mac OS X Lion in 10.7. So that means if you have Office 2004 and that's your only version of Office, Office 2004 is not going to run, and then by that token, you're not going to be able to open your Office files because you're not going to have a functioning version of Office. It does not mean that if you have Office 2004 files, so files that were saved with Office 2004, and you have a newer version of Office that runs on 10.7, something that was written for Intel, that will still be able to open up those Office 2004 files. You'll be able to open them up and convert them to a newer version of Office. And so another topic that came up because of this discussion about Rosetta is the fact that Snow Leopard does not have Rosetta installed by default. It still has support for Rosetta, and Rosetta is that technology that allows you to run older PowerPC applications in Mac OS X on the current Intel hardware. Rosetta is not installed by default. It's actually an optional install. It's something you need to go back and install directly from your disks. Now, what should happen, your original system disks? So what should happen is if you run an application that is PowerPC only on Snow Leopard, it should pop up an alert telling you that you need to actually install Rosetta, and it should give you the option to put in your disks and actually install that. If that doesn't happen and you know you have an application that is a PowerPC app, you may have to go back to your original disks and manually reinstall Rosetta. Just something to be aware of in Snow Leopard. In Leopard, it was part of the default install, and you should be able to run PowerPC applications just fine right alongside your Intel native applications if you have a newer Mac. Now, the other thing that this made me think about is that depending on your needs, so if you're the type of person, you have Office 2004, you're running it now, you're running Snow Leopard, you've installed Rosetta, everything's working fine for you, and you rely on that. That's a program, Office 2004 is a program you rely on each and every day, you need it to get your job done, and you aren't considering upgrading your hardware, you don't have a huge need to actually upgrade or move beyond that, then you know what, sometimes there's nothing wrong with not upgrading to the latest and greatest stuff. I think a lot of times, you know, us, especially us geeks, we think we always need to have the latest and greatest stuff. We need to upgrade. We need to get to 10.7 and 10, you know, and a lot of us are even go even more to the bleeding edge and, you know, sign up for the developer program and get the beta builds and install everything, you know, really quickly. But, you know, if you have your Mac and you rely on it to do certain types of work and you need it to be reliable and you need it to be working all the time, and you've gotten to that point in that situation where your Mac is completely stable, you might not always need to run the latest and greatest stuff. Or at the very least, you might want to wait a little bit till some of the bugs are worked out with the newer stuff, and maybe it gets a couple point releases in and it's a little more stable before you actually make the leap and actually do your upgrade. And I think a lot of times, us geeks, we don't give ourselves the permission to not upgrade, to not be running the latest and greatest stuff. There's not always a great advantage to being on the bleeding edge. Yeah, it can be a lot of fun, but it can also be frustrating at the same time. You know, we get all these whiz-bang latest greatest features, but we're also dealing with being kind of the public beta testers of a lot of this stuff. So, you know, we talk about backward compatibility and format shifting and stuff like that, but in the same token, in the same breath, we also should be talking about stability and the advantages of, if it isn't broken, don't fix it. If you don't need those latest and greatest features and you have critical stuff that is working and running on your current system, then you might want to stick with the current system for a while, at least until you get to the point where it makes sense to upgrade or there's a compelling reason to upgrade. I'm not saying you stay on the oldest stuff forever. That's another trap that I think people get into, because Macs last for a really long time. They have really good longevity. But I think the adage that applies really in almost all cases, and I keep coming back to this in a number of areas, is that let the application dictate your actions. So if you have an application that requires you to upgrade, that might be the indication of now's the time to upgrade. But if you don't have an immediate need for it and you're just doing it for the sake of doing it, then you need to think about that for a little bit. And if you're willing to accept potential consequences of things breaking or dealing with bugs or issues, stuff like we mentioned earlier, even with doing a point release upgrade, suddenly your OpenType fonts don't work. Well, that could get you really in trouble. If you're a graphics professional and you rely on those OpenType fonts, here you are now having to spend hours rolling back your operating system, and you don't necessarily want to be doing that. So maybe you have an extra machine that you can try it out on first, or you can let someone else be the guinea pig. And sometimes that's the smarter way to go. And I do think that as geeks, we have to give ourselves permission to not upgrade. Being a podcaster, something that I think a lot about is media, both audio and video media, and how that's changing in the times that we're in and shifting and stuff like that. And a story that came up this week was that some of the record labels are experimenting with releasing albums as standalone apps on the App Store. Specifically, Universal Music Group and EMI have released an application, an iOS app for $9.99 that is, in essence, an album with some extra bonus features, videos and commentary, and I think a book and things like that. It could be a myriad of things. And we saw this a few months back with Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers has started to release some of their films as standalone apps. I think specifically they did Inception and The Dark Knight. They actually released those as free applications, and then you could upgrade the apps for $9.99 or $11.99 to get the full movie and extras and things like that. And one of the advantages of that for Warner Brothers was it allowed them to get their films released into countries and on iOS devices in countries that hadn't picked up the iTunes movie store yet. So there's some revenue advantages to them doing that. But beyond that, it's an interesting thing to me of specifically with regards to the music of the record labels trying to get back, I think, something that they've lost with the release of iTunes and digital music. And that is the move back to people buying whole albums. And I think what they think is if we release this as an app, then someone's going to buy the app and they're going to get the whole album, and we're going to recapture that $10 sale rather than that 99-cent sale that we're getting from the single app. And you know, while it's neat to have all this bonus content, I have to wonder, does it actually really work, or are they thinking about what consumers want, stuff like that? If you remember, Apple, what, about a year ago or a couple years ago, released the iTunes LP, which was supposed to be this great thing that would bring album sales back to iTunes, and you'd want to buy these iTunes LPs. And while they're really neat, and I've played around with a couple of them, and it's cool to have the bonus features and stuff like that, on a practical basis, it really just hasn't worked out very well. Or I don't know that many people that are buying iTunes LPs versus just buying either single tracks or albums on iTunes. I think the movie apps were a little more well received by the media, but I don't know if consumers have even really taken to the apps. I've heard some people say that the Inception app is pretty cool, and I've thought about downloading it and trying it, but I really haven't. But I think what the movie industry and the record industry are missing, and the point that they're missing, is that some of those old days are gone, and it's just time to move on. They really need to kind of get over it. Strategy Analytics did a recent study, and they showed that CD sales, traditional CD sales, you know, the plastic discs, they're expecting those to be down 40%, and that digital sales will continue to rise. But the problem for the record industry is that they're not matching pace. So digital sales in terms of revenue is not going up as quickly as lost revenue from CD sales is declining. Now, they predict that by 2015, digital sales will be about 39% singles and 32% albums, and then 14% in streaming, things like Rhapsody and stuff like that. But that shows that the single is still going to be the dominant thing, and I think the music industry needs to accept that and conform and figure out how do we make a lot of money off singles. And they need to adapt to the changing consumer dynamic, the thing that consumers want, which right now consumers are saying is the single. Now, I think they could affect that in some way, but I think the better, you know, by trying to force album sales or force how we buy things or bundle things together, I don't know, but I think that's the wrong strategy to be taking. And this is just my opinion. I think they'd be better off trying to maximize profits on singles. Also, I think that they could probably sell more singles. They could maximize volume if they would adjust their pricing to reflect what I think are lower digital distribution costs. Now, I'm making a huge assumption here on my own part. I don't know that it's cheaper for a label to release a digital single and sell that versus putting out a physical disc, but I have to imagine with packaging and printing and all the other costs that go into it that they have to be saving some money by distributing content digitally. I also think that artists can probably focus on making content more compelling to force album sales. I have to say that in my case, my purchasing of albums has not gone down with the advent of digital distribution. On iTunes, I still, for my favorite artists, prefer to buy the entire album when they release a new album. I don't like this onesie twosie thing. Now, I'm older, so that may be just my mentality, and maybe the concern is the younger generation who's growing up on just buying singles and only buying singles. But, you know, I have to think that the industry needs to just change and adapt, and they really aren't. And I don't know what that means for their future, but I have to imagine that trying to force the issue of us buying entire albums by only making music available, say, by apps. And I know they're not doing that yet, but that seems to be something that they're looking at or experimenting with this announcement of these new, you know, apps as albums, that's just not the right way to go. And especially when you think that when you sell it as an app, I don't have the tracks to sync over to my iPod or my iPad, the devices that I want to take with me and have my music on. So are they going to move everything to the cloud? Is streaming going to be the way to go? It seems like streaming is a poorer revenue model than singles, if you ask me. And they seem to be okay with that, at least with some services. Google announced their new cloud music service, and I'm not sure which labels are on board with that. But, you know, this sort of get everything for a really cheap price seems like a really bad revenue model, and I'm not sure why they're adapting to that. And, you know, maybe with albums coming out as apps, AirPlay technology might be able to help with that, and AirPlay compatible devices and speaker systems, so we can actually get the content out of the app and onto a TV or into a speaker system. But long term, that seems like not a desirable option to me. So I don't know. I don't know what your opinion is, but that kind of came up this week, this whole app thing, and got me thinking about shifting media, the shifting changes of how we consume our media and where we get our media from, and sort of the future of the music and movie industry. And it's constantly changing dynamic, and I think Apple's providing some great tools for them to take advantage of new models, but I don't really see them rushing to jump on board, and they seem to be fighting it every step of the way. And as a consumer, that seems to be frustrating, or that gets frustrating, at least to me. All right, in rant mode. Sorry, every once in a while I have to get some stuff off my chest. I don't know if you agree with me or disagree with me, but I'd love your thoughts and comments on any of that stuff. Okay, Richie has a problem with his podcast, and I think we should help him out. Richie sometimes sent me an email, said he sometimes gets duplicate groups of podcasts. So he subscribed to some podcasts, and every once in a while he goes into his podcast section and, say, for example, if it was the MacCast, rather than just seeing one section that says MacCast, you'll see MacCast twice, and there might be one episode under one section and the rest of the episodes under the other section. And he was wondering, what's going on there? Why do I have suddenly two MacCasts and I've only subscribed to one feed? And I have a feeling, I'm just guessing here, but I've seen this happen before, and it's likely due to the podcast metadata that was added to the track before it was uploaded to the server and before it was picked up via the feed and downloaded into your iTunes. And specifically, probably what's happening is that there's a slight difference in either the album title or the album title sort field metadata. And it probably just something where the podcaster made a mistake in entering it. I know I've done it before uploading. And then what happens is because the metadata is different when it gets pulled down by iTunes, it sees that as different albums or different shows and then puts it under different sections. So luckily, it's pretty easy to fix on your end. What you can do is go in, select the track in iTunes that is, you know, in the wrong section or wrong category, and then do a get info on it in iTunes, and then go through the metadata and make sure the metadata is exactly the same for that track as it is for the tracks that are in the correct section. And once you clear up that mismatch, iTunes should go ahead, go in and reconsolidate them and put them all under the single podcast again, and then you can resync over your devices and it should be all cleaned up. If you do see that, you probably want to just send a nice note to the podcaster letting them to know you noticed the discrepancy, and they can probably correct the feed or correct the files and re-upload them and get them cleaned up on their end so that anybody else downloading the podcast in the future won't have that same issue crop up. But if you ever have that happen to you, just double check the metadata and look at not just the track information, but also there's that sorting tab in iTunes. Make sure that it's consistent there as well. And once it's cleaned up in both locations, it should get cleared up. So, Richie, I hope that helps you clear up that situation. And I guess at the risk of going into another little mini rant, the last item I have for you today is a question or a comment that came from Tim, and it's regarding the new in-app subscriptions for magazines and publications.
Hi, Adam. This is Tim Brown. I wanted to call you about something that's really been bugging me. I was listening to another tech show, TNT, and they were talking about the new subscription plan the New York Times is offering and what this is going to mean for the future of news online and so forth. Another thing that has dawned on me is what's going to happen with... Well, one topic that came up was how are people going to want to go to one source for their news, or are they going to prefer many sources? And, well, I'm one that prefers many sources, and which is the reason why I prefer RSS feeds. Now, I noticed that, you know, just about any news website has, you know, a ton of RSS feeds, including the New York Times. Well, is the New York Times going to abandon the RSS feed model in order to limit the access to the information that they're providing? And if so, do you see this as a trend? You know, the RSS feed apps are, right now, my favorite apps. Whether it's Flipboard or Pulse or Flood or what have you. I mean, these are apps that are fantastic. BlogShelf, I mean, you name it. They're all fantastic because you can get your news through RSS feeds. And it's just a great way to get your news. But is this going to become a problem in the future as people start to become more proprietary about how they deliver their information? Anyway, I would love to get your feedback on that. Thank you.
Hey, Tim. You know what? As somebody who makes his living off of RSS feeds, I have to agree. I love RSS feeds. RSS feeds are great. I love getting my news from multiple sources. I would agree with you there. As far as what's happening with the New York Times, you know, they're announcing they're moving their stuff behind a paywall, pretty much. But the other thing is that there's always going to be a certain amount of content that is free. I think part of the problem is that, like we were talking about with the music and the movie industry, everybody's trying to figure out this media stuff in an internet age, in an age where everybody thinks the internet should be free and content in the internet should be free. But somebody still has to create and sweat and work hard to actually make this stuff. And we're finding more and more that as people have the ability and option to skip over or avoid advertising or bypass advertising, they're doing it more and more. And that means the old models of ad-supported stuff are kind of dying. What's interesting is at the same time, Apple is making ad-supported stuff more viable when it comes to apps. we're starting to see low and free apps due to the fact that there are ads in them now and it's supported that way. But they're trying to create more compelling and useful and effective ads with the iAd programs to make it more attractive to advertisers to maybe spend a little bit more. Maybe they're getting less impressions, but they're getting more targeted impressions. And that's something that we try and do with podcasts, too. I think one of the advantages of podcasts is that we can bring maybe a smaller audience, but a more targeted, more valuable audience to advertisers. And when the ads are more relevant, I think they're less annoying and less likely to be skipped. But that's just a theory at this point. So everybody's kind of playing around with the models. And I think what you're seeing with the New York Times is they're playing around with their model. But I would say yes, they're absolutely going to move their RSS feeds behind a paywall, and at least partially, and you're going to have to pay to get at some of the content. But I also think that we're seeing the emergence of this idea of a freemium model, and we see it in apps, and I think we're going to see it more and more with media and content too, where, you know what, if you want to get the ad-supported version, it's going to be free, or it's going to be ad supported or cheaper, and you'll be able to get that version at a better price. If you want to avoid the ads, or if you want to get more content or extra content, there's going to be a premium option where you can choose to pay and subsidize some of the cost of that content. And for that, you're going to get extra, or you're going to get more. But I think everybody's trying to figure it out. I think it is really a changing dynamic, and those who are going to survive are going to have to adapt both on the content creation side and on the content consumption side. The old way of doing things just doesn't hold up. But the good news for us is that the dinosaurs are dying out, they're going away, and those who are willing to accept or embrace the new models and the new ways of doing things are really going to survive. And Apple, I think, is making great strides to kind of changing the model. They've done it with iTunes, and they've sort of brought industries along kicking and screaming. And they've succeeded to a certain degree with the music industry. I think they're still struggling on the cloud front, but they've worked on the television and the movie studios, and they're kind of halfway there, I think. And the publishers are getting there with iBooks and those sorts of technologies. And now we have the subscription thing. And at least they've held up an option for digital publishers for a subscription model that could work if they want to take advantage of it. And that remains to be seen whether they're going to jump on board or not. But the publishing industry themselves did not provide a solution for themselves. So Apple has provided one, and they can kind of take it or leave it. And we're going to have to see how that shakes out and what happens with that. But ultimately, it's consumers that are going to dictate what they want. And content providers are going to either have to provide that or they will go away. And I think the good news is with the types of technologies and how easy it is to create content now, you're going to have other content creators who will step up and take advantage of the new models and the new technologies and figure out how to deliver to consumers what they want. So if what you want is free RSS feeds, there is going to be someone out there that is going to find a way to provide that for you and to be able to make a living doing that. So where there's a will, there's a way, and where we can adapt, we will survive. So kind of sounds Darwinistic maybe, or survival of the fittest, but evolution finds a way to survive. And I think we're going to be okay in the long run. And content is here to stay. Content is always going to be around. And as long as there's people to consume it, it will find a way to get into our hands. I guess that's the way to put it. So just my opinion. I'm sure some of you have opinions on that. Please send along your emails, your thoughts, your comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. And I welcome receiving those. And with that, that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, Speaking of sponsors and finding a way to deliver content, I want to thank all of my sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, some awesome applications for your Mac. You can check all that stuff out and get free demos and trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. Check out their software. Get more information over at Phoronix.com. A big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening, staying subscribed. I appreciate that. If you have any comments for me, a question, something you want to talk about and you want to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to send in audio comments, record something on your iPhone or your iPad, and send that along. I welcome those, and you might hear yourself on a future episode of the MacCast. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave your voicemail there. If you do, please leave your email address, and if you can spell it out for me, that's greatly appreciated. If you'd like to call in on Skype, my Skype address is TheMacCast. There's a voicemail there, so you can leave your messages on Skype. And if you need to find the show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.